welcome to this evening's seminar. I'm Louise Locock. I'm the Deputy Research Director for the Health Experiences Research Group in Oxford and a Research Fellow at Green Templeton. And the format for today, before I move on to introduce people, is that we're going to have James first for around half an hour, then we'll have a quarter hour slot for questions, discussion around that presentation. Then we'll move on to Malte, and then we'll have another targeted session for questions about Malte's presentation, followed by more general opportunities for discussion. So I'd like to move on to present James Munro, who is the Director of Research at Patient Opinion, and he'll tell us more about what that is. He has a background in clinical medicine and public health, and moved into research at the University of Sheffield and has been at Patient Opinion for the last 7 years. So, James, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for inviting me to this. Great pleasure to be here. Particular pleasure to be here with Malte. As you'll hear, it's taken Malte some getting to be here because he was in New York recently. And as you've heard, I'm going to kick us off. I feel no particular personal pressure here because I'm not the academic in the room. Malte's the academic, so he has to say the rigorous and evidence-based things. I just have to talk about what I do. So I'm hoping the pressure is off from my side. And we thought we'd really just talk about stories. That's what Patient Opinion does, and that's what we're talking about. And I'm going to tell you something about what we do at Patient Opinion, how it works, and then say something about how we think we're changing the world. And then Malte will apply a certain rigour to what I've told you and explain how it's all much more complicated than I've said. I think that's how it's going to work out. I don't really know. I don't know what he's going to say. So we live in a world that's changing extraordinarily quickly and changing in some quite remarkable ways. And one of the ways that it's changing is that everybody now has a voice, potentially, through being able to go online. And the cost of having that voice has fallen to effectively zero. And that is a very new phenomenon in historical terms. Historically, for people to have a voice that was audible to a large population, they had to run a TV channel or own a newspaper or be a monarch or whatever it might be. And now everybody can put up their picture of their chicken and mushroom pie that they've been served in hospital for lunch whenever they feel like it, and the whole world can see it. That's not to say the whole world will see it, but potentially the whole world could see it. And that's what people are doing. People are posting online about their healthcare experiences every day and every minute of every day. And of course, sharing healthcare experiences isn't anything new. People have always, as long as there's been healthcare, people have shared their experiences of that. They've typically shared those experiences face-to-face with family and friends. They typically haven't shared those experiences globally, but now they are doing, and they're sharing them increasingly rapidly and increasingly globally and continually, really. And this is Twitter. I don't know if any of you are on Twitter. We know there's some tweeting going on back there, which is good. But people are tweeting every day about their healthcare experiences. And if you go onto Twitter and follow the NHS hashtag, you will see, in the morning, you will see lots of people tweeting about how they can't get through to their GPs. And then in the afternoon, you'll see them all tweeting about, mother and baby clinics. And then in the evening, they'll be tweeting about visiting people in hospital. And that's continuous and sometimes very specific. Sometimes very specific. It's specific to a particular provider. And it may be positive and it may be negative. And if you are offended by swear words, don't follow the NHS hashtag, because it's a very mixed picture of feedback that you'll see there. And of course, we think of Twitter as something for young, trendy folk, but that's not always the case. This was Ivy Bean. She was 104 when she was on Twitter. She was in a care home. She was obviously very famous on Twitter because she was 104. And so she had lots of followers, including Peter Andre, who came to visit her in a care home. You know what these people are like. There's some specific feedback for her care home, or for the rest of us, about what her care home is like. And I think that's an extraordinary phenomenon. And I'll go on to talk about, really, what can we do with that? does that mean? So those are very unstructured forms of feedback that we see online about healthcare and social care. And obviously there have been much more structured and still are much more structured forms appearing as well. This is NHS Choices, which incidentally takes feedback from patient opinion as well and brings it all together. And you can see what people are saying about a particular hospital. That's obviously much more structured, bringing things into one place, showing you that feedback. There's another site called I Want Great Care, which does feedback about individual clinicians as well as location, so you can see if your doctor's on there and what people are saying about your doctor. It's a slightly odd site in that almost all of the feedback is completely positive, which I'm not quite sure why that is, but I suppose it's better than it all being completely negative. And this is, I think this is a thing that people have very mixed feelings about. This extraordinary great wave. I mean, the Hokusai's great wave was painted during a period of great insecurity in Japan when it was opening its trade borders to the world and feeling overwhelmed by what might happen and how that might work out. Obviously, you know, for quite a time it worked out pretty well. The question, I think, for the NHS is, how is this going to work out for us? This great wave of comment, of feedback, of transparency, of people talking about what we do, how do we cope with that? And there's a couple of things you can do when faced with a great wave. And one of them is to sort of hold tight, like these characters are in their boats, and hope that it just goes over you and goes past in some kind of way. The chances are it probably won't. It'll probably end up capsizing these guys. The other possibility with a great wave is to try and surf it. If you can get on top of it, you might be able to move faster. And actually, one way of looking at the great wave of social media is, these are people who are wanting health services to be better. They're wanting to help health services get better. And so there's an extraordinary possibility here, which is, how can we mobilise the energy and the experiences and expertise and the insights of patients to help their health services be as good as they can be? And that's really what patient opinion is all about. That's what we want to do. So in our worldview, in patient opinion's kind of dream, if you like, of the world, and we are incorrigible optimists, I have to say, we imagine a world in which it's very easy for people to give their feedback. We know that people who've had poor experiences of healthcare typically don't give honest feedback to the health service, and there are two well-known reasons for that. One is they're scared, and the other thing is they think it's pointless. Now, it may be that we can overcome those particular obstacles by going online if we do things well. So that's part of what we're about. We want to make it safe and easy for people to give their feedback. We will also want to make it safe and easy, though, for staff to receive that feedback. And that's not something you can easily do on Flickr or Twitter or Facebook. We need to be able to get that feedback to the people who need to see it so they know how their care is being experienced. And that could be all kinds of different people in the system. And then we want to, ideally, we want to see that feedback not just amassed in a pile. We don't see this as data to be collected. We see this as stories to be acted upon and the world to be changed as a result. We'd like to see services change and improve as a result of that feedback. And what's extraordinary then about this particular way of doing it, about doing it online, is that then potentially everybody can see that. So it's not, here's a suggestion box, put your suggestions in and then we'll take them away and we might tell you what we did with your suggestion, but we might not. This is a very public process where everybody can see inside the suggestion box and see what's happened or hasn't happened as a result. So that's what we are up to. That's what patient opinion is trying to do. And this is a screenshot of the site a few days back. These are real people, incidentally, who told their stories, and those stories led to change. This is a member of staff. And you can see that, in a sense, our unit of currency, that what we work with, is people's stories coming in. And we try and take every story that comes in and attach it to the services that it's about. And then we try and use our alerting systems to send emails to those right people and get them to see it, and then we hope they may respond. And we try and make it as transparent as we can, the extent to which that feedback is leading to responses and the extent to which it's leading to changes. So this is about trying to create a public feedback loop that everybody can see operating or not operating. And of course, it varies from place to place and from time to time how well that works. Here's our mid-staffs, obviously a hospital frequently in the news, and we're still waiting for the Francis report to come out, hopefully in January. And you can type mid-staffs into patient opinion, and that will come to the page with the feedback coming in and people telling their stories, what was good, what wasn't, and you can see whether they're responding, how many staff are actually listening, how many stories have led to changes. These are tags that are added to the stories by people who've submitted them, which say what they felt was good or what could have been better, and you can click on those tags to drill down and see those particular stories if you want to. And when we started this, everybody said, that's just a terrible idea, because it will just be endless whinging and moaning about how awful everything is. Everybody knows it's all awful, and patients will just tell you how awful it all is, and that will be the end of that. Actually, it turns out over half of what you receive is completely positive. And this is an example. The other reason I like this example is positive, which is great. It's about something quite intimate. And there's something quite extraordinary, I think, about the way that people will share very intimate experiences with the whole world when they feel safe enough that actually their identity will be protected and they can say what they want. And it's very specific as well. It's not just, I was satisfied or I'd recommend this service to somebody else. It was, here's why. It was, here's why that I was satisfied. Here's what mattered to me. So this is a nice positive story, and you can see the woman here adding her tags there as well. But what about changing the world? How and to what extent does giving feedback like this actually lead to any change? And of course, that is always going to be an empirical question. There's no guarantee that it ever could or necessarily will. So here's just a few examples of small changes that we see on patient opinion. This is somebody whose mother was admitted to hospital. She'd been in the habit of talking to her regularly on the phone. Of course, at the very moment she's admitted and actually would like to maintain that contact, she can't because there's no portable handset on the ward. So this woman, I think, we interviewed her actually afterwards, and she actually had very little expectation that anything would happen as a result of giving her feedback in this way. But luckily somebody was listening. The director of facilities was receiving emails from patient opinion. He received the email alert. And in a very short time, he'd taken action. I think pretty much the same day. He said, I've gone down to the ward and had a look, and you're absolutely right, and there's no portable phone on your mother's ward, so I've arranged for a portable phone to be provided. And I've gone round the other wards to see which ones don't have portable phones, and we'll get those organised too. And said what people often say, which is sometimes this may be too late for you, but at least your suggestion will help change things for the next person, which I think is very often what patients want. I mean, that's what motivates people really to give feedback. And Becky came the very next day just to update and say, you know, the handsets are on order, there's a portable phone on your mother's ward, and then we give people who respond to patient opinion a box they can tick or a button they can press that says we've made a change, and then people can see not only this story led to a portable handset, that very specific thing, but also this organisation is the sort of organisation that listens to what people are saying and makes changes in real time. And I think one of the things people are increasingly interested in about when they're coming to choosing or looking at the quality of providers in healthcare is not just what people say about them, but how those organisations respond to what people say about them. It's actually the responses on patient opinion that can give you a particular insight into the culture of an organisation. I don't know if you know this cartoon. It says, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. This means quite a lot to me. I think this is one of the great things. On patient opinion, we have feedback from people who self-harm, people with bipolar, people with incontinence, people who can't get out because they're looking after a partner with dementia, and so on and so forth. We have feedback from all sorts of extraordinary people, not the sorts of people necessarily who would come to a focus group or attend a public meeting or even fill in a form. And this is one of those people. This is somebody who's an opiate addict, and he goes up to the clinic for his script. This is in Warrington. And one of the problems he finds is he goes up on a Friday to get his methadone prescription. If he doesn't have the fare for the bus, he misses the bus, and then he doesn't get it, and then he's got no methadone for the weekend. And then we all know what happens when you haven't got any methadone for the weekend. You're going to find something somewhere. And so the trust has to have a Monday morning mop-up clinic where all the people who've got into trouble over the weekend taking all sorts of things come along and try and get sorted out on a Monday morning. So his very reasonable question was, well, why do you end prescriptions on Fridays? And this, we fired this posting off, as we always do, to the commissioners and providers in the area, the drug and alcohol people and the relevant people. And they had a bit of a debate on the site and realised that actually there was no good reason to end prescriptions on Fridays. Nobody had ever thought of it before. It just hadn't occurred to anybody that there might be a question there. So after a bit of toing and froing, they came back and said, you know, we won't end prescriptions on Fridays, we'll just make that a policy from now on, and that's that. Which I thought was a very positive thing, and I think at that point then it bubbled up to be regional policy as well. And the story goes, and I don't know if this is true, but I repeat it simply because somebody told me, that the Trust no longer needs its Monday morning mop-up clinic as a result. So that's a kind of a win-win, isn't it? And those sorts of things make us obviously very happy at patient opinion. So these are small changes in specific things. But you could see that the accumulation of these things could amount to something substantial. We asked people in a survey last year about how they felt about complaining after they'd posted on patient opinion after they'd received a response, because people asked us whether using patient opinion affected the number of complaints to health services. And the answer is we have no idea whether it does. And I think we'd need some fairly ambitious research to find out. But we thought we'd just start with a survey and see what people felt themselves about whether they felt like complaining. And one of the questions was whether people felt more or less like complaining after they'd received a response on patient opinion. Bear in mind, not everybody does. And here are a couple of people saying that they did feel less like complaining after they received a response. And that was because this was somebody who felt listened to, and they felt they'd had a good explanation of what happened. And they like the fact that it was all in the open. In a sense, there's a public record being created here, and it is a very public record being created. Somebody else feeling that, you know, whatever they said had been taken on and actually would help people in the future. But then there were others who said actually they felt more like complaining after the health service had responded to them. And typically that was because they felt that actually their concerns hadn't been heard. They may have received a response, but that didn't imply anything about somebody hearing. We were having a bit of a joke in the office recently because I bought our chief exec a copy of The Most Human. Have you seen that book? It's about the Turing test. You know about when you try and write computer programs that pretend to be humans, and then there's a competition every year to see whether any of the programs can pass the test, and nobody can spot that they aren't a human. Anyway, it's quite interesting trying to look at response on patient opinion and decide which organisations have human beings responded and which ones could be computer programs. That's another blog post, I think. So somebody feeling like that, somebody else feeling, okay, they did come back and they said do this and then I did that and then that wasn't any good either. So people ending up feeling more frustrated. And I think just highlighting the fact that, okay, this starts off looking like a technology, but actually it's not a technology. When it comes down to it, it's just another way of communicating. And if the person you're communicating with is just as frustrating as everybody else, it's not really going to take you a long way forwards. This is an example of when that did turn out well. Again, just a small change. Somebody upset by the way she was treated in the ambulance services in Scotland. She felt her symptoms had been misinterpreted and played down, and therefore the A&E staff treated her in a different way. And the service, you can see we record everybody in the health service who reads the story, so you can tell that your story's been heard if you want. And then the service coming back and saying, look, we really need to talk to you about this. And the user being able to, without revealing who she was, being able to come back and say, I'm not sure if I feel safe about that. It might not be safe for me to actually talk to you. So there's an interesting negotiation going on before you reveal who you are. And actually she was convinced after a little while to talk to the service. You know, the service was very reassuring about that. And she did. But what was nice about this story was then she came back again at the end and said she'd had a very helpful conversation and resolved things. And I like this story partly because you can see how the conversation can lead to a change in relationship, but also partly because you can see how sometimes conversations can start online as a way of testing whether it's safe to go face-to-face, and then after they've been face-to-face, they can come back online again. people don't necessarily make a strong distinction between doing this online and doing it face to face. Okay, so those are the small changes. That's small ways that stories change the world. But what about bigger ways? Are there any bigger ways? In our slightly more pompous and megalomaniac phases, we do think we're having a bigger impact, and we think that we're part of a bigger story, because there's a history to healthcare, and healthcare history to some degree can be seen as a history of increasing transparency, of increasing openness, of opening institutions, and perhaps even of decreasing power gaps between those who use services and those who provide them. And this, you'll probably recognise, this is Bentham's Panopticon, a building designed so that a single nurse or warder standing at the centre could see everybody and therefore potentially keep everybody under control. So sort of minimal staffing, maximal efficiency in terms of monitoring what was going on. I think what's interesting about going online is the way that that notion of the panopticon of surveillance, of uniform surveillance, gets turned upside down. And now we have this notion of surveillance, of keeping an eye on what's happening from below, not from above, not from a position of power, but from a position of lack of power. And I just pulled out a few examples last night from patient opinion where we see that happening. This is somebody reporting about their hospital stay. There were examples of nurses from all grades who I witnessed being unhelpful and making this patient feel very uncomfortable. Senior members of staff on the ward one day, down to and including auxiliary staff. This is somebody just reporting verbatim and in more or less real time what they're seeing happen on a ward, normally a closed place, not a public place, but now because of online feedback becoming more public. Here's somebody else saying the tea boy was rude and chatting up a nurse, which I found very unprofessional. When the frail old woman asked if he could pass the tea to her that he'd just poured into a beaker for her, he said, "Sorry, love, I'm not trained for that," and just left her. Okay, so these, if you worked on NHS wards, you'll probably sigh slightly and think, yeah, you know, we see that happen. But not everybody sees that happen, but now everybody can see that happen. And there's a question here about how will that affect healthcare and healthcare cultures into the future. The other thing that intrigues me is that we sometimes see on patient opinion, which I think is a result of this increasing transparency now. This is something that we may not have been aware of. It's what I'm calling peer-to-peer care. Actually, the notion of informal care being carried out by patients for other patients within a formal care setting. So this is an example of that. Somebody taking an old lady to the toilet. It's quite obvious the other nursing staff what I was doing, but it took a few minutes to help the lady there. Nobody helped. When the lady had been re-cleaned up, a nurse had just come on duty, came to the toilet, she recognised the patient's voice and didn't recognise my voice as a nurse. Whilst this elderly lady was confused, she was by no means unaware of the humiliating situation she was in. This is somebody looking after another patient on a ward in a formal care setting where you would imagine that actually taking patients to the toilet might be the first priority, not the last point. So I just think it's fascinating that, here's another example, that these things can come to light because of the contemporaneous reports of people just writing about and feeding back what they witness daily on wards. This is another story about being given a drink and trying to make sure that the patient actually gets the drink that they want. And bearing in mind also that patient opinion is widely used in mental health care too, where of course, you know, there's a whole different set of stories to be told. So just finishing up now, this tweet recently from Hillary Clinton's senior advisor for innovation caught my eye, and I think it's, in some sense, this is the big ways that stories are changing the world, and I think will change the world, is that this great wave of social media is leading to a question about who's open to this and who's closed to it. Which organisations are open? Which ones are transparent? Which ones are prepared to engage with their publics? And which ones are not? I thought this was a really quite a striking thought, that actually it's open v closed that we'll need to keep an eye on in the current century. We involve lots of people in the stories. We can send them all over the place. There's lots of audiences. Morte will talk about, there are lots of audiences and lots of uses for the stories we collect. obviously they go to providers, they go to regulators, they can go to commissioners, they can go to health watch and patient groups, they can go to academics too. And I think there's an extraordinary research agenda here, all sorts of questions to be asked about, well, why do people share their stories and what do they expect to happen and what does happen? And how do people feel who are the subjects of those stories, who are being observed, if you like? And how good is the NHS at reacting to feedback and showing that it does so? A whole range of research questions to be asked. So, just to finish up, we think stories do change the world. We think they are changing the world. We hope they'll continue. These are real people who told real stories. This is the one I showed you earlier. So we can point, and as I say, it is an empirical question, we can point to small ways in which these stories are changing the world. But the bigger way, which is to what extent are these stories, will they change culture? Will they change organisations? Will they change the way clinicians in the future relate to service users in the future? I think is still very much an open question. And I do hope, sooner or later, that somebody will start to research that. So with that, I'll stop. And very happy to take any questions.
And, well, there's a break for technology requirements. I'll introduce Marta Siewicz, who did his DPhil at Oxford in the Side Business School, and part of it was an ethnography of patient opinion, which is what he's going to be talking about today. That wasn't the whole topic of the thesis. And Marta's now on a two-year postdoc research fellowship in the Department of Media, Culture and Communication at New York University. So he's been a bit battered by the winds recently, having only just moved in when it all happened, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, over to you.
In a way, again. So, brilliant. Thank you very much. Let me just get my notes. Maybe I should start with a quick note on doing research and being the researcher of an organization, one of the directors of which has presented right before you. So James announced me now as the guy who will explain the whole thing to you with real rigor and detail. And if you're hoping that I will do that, I have to disappoint you, because that's probably not the case. And the reason is, as you can see, I'm doing ethnography. That means I engage with organizations. I basically work with them as an intern, as someone who hangs out with guys like James, and then takes a lot of notes, conducts interviews, collects documents, analyzes them later, and so accumulates this body of stories, basically, of narratives. And so there's an interesting duplication here, which you can keep in mind during the next half an hour when I'm going to tell you some of these stories, what it means to tell stories behind stories or stories about stories. And that was a big challenge in this research, and that's also the reason why you cannot expect that I'm going to tell you the truth now. And different way of understanding is that sometimes people think of ethnography as doing an ethnography of an organization, and usually these ethnographies claim have a strong realist claim, right? So they claim to tell people this is how the organization really is, and now I'm going to tell you the truth and debunk. This is not the way I have approached this ethnography. It's very much rather an ethnography with an organization and in an organization. So by becoming part of it and still keeping this distance, I've been trying to reflect on my experience of becoming an insider while being an outsider. So that was my approach to this. And so the only revelation I can make today is that you can feel really honored, because it is the first time ever that I've seen James wearing a tie. This is a very special moment, and you can consider yourself really very, very lucky. So what am I going to do today? I thought a lot about this, actually, because we are obviously quite a mixed audience, and so usually I frame this a whole lot more in terms of the theory to which I'm supposed to contribute as a researcher and a scholar. So what I'm going to do today is I actually focus also on telling stories from my experience of doing an ethnography at Patient Opinion. But before I start with that, I will briefly, just to give you a bit of background, tell you how I entered the topic and how I got to work with Patient Opinion, because this might be interesting for you to understand. The reason I'm going to tell you a bit about this is that I was not born, not raised, and also not trained as a healthcare researcher. researcher. So I come from an area of digital media, of public policy, of law originally. So my interest initially was in what I perceived at the time, about 5-6 years ago, as this rise of really web-based patient feedback. So initially there was a platform like eBay, which some of you might have used on the internet, where you buy things and then evaluate the buyer or seller, or Amazon, you've probably seen the book reviews, right, of dishwashers and so on. And what I found fascinating and what people in this area discussed increasingly is there's a really wave of schemes that try to harness the feedback and the evaluations of many users and people in order to basically produce some useful knowledge. So there's something, there's a website for ex-boyfriends, for instance, called Don't Date Them Girls. There's a website for IT freelancers, which is a bit more serious, of course, where you, when you want to hire a computer programmer, you basically understand what work he's done before. Rate my professors, how's my nanny.com is nanny, rate my knitting is quite obvious. Expedia and TripAdvisor have been very much in the news about travel, hotels, the hospitality industries. There's general platforms like Review Center, Kype, or Yelp. There's a website for where you can upload your own photo and have other people decide whether you're hot or not. And there's sites for lawyers like Avvo and so on and so on and so on. So that was something that I found quite interesting, this rise in this culture of web-based evaluation. Now, the interesting thing is that this then at some point was mobilized also for the public sector. And I very much understand that this is something, right, that started in the business world, in the e-commerce world. So, and I thought an interesting quote to illustrate this is actually this quote, which I took from a government report working together in 2009. That must have been under the Gordon Brown government, I think. And this was a report which was very enthusiastic about these things, and I just read it out loud. The report said, people take it for granted that they will access other people's reviews and ratings before buying something on eBay or Amazon, and yet we do not yet have systematic access to other people's experiences when choosing a GP practice or nursery. We've clearly got the balance wrong when online businesses have higher standards of transparency than the public services we pay for and support. We are ushering in a new world of accountability in which parents, patients, and local communities shape the services they receive, ensuring all our public services respond not simply to the hand of government, but to the voice of local people. So this is a very programmatic statement I took from this report, which all in all sounds very similar, but I chose it here as an illustration of what I perceive as the more general debate and discourse about these schemes, especially as they apply to in the public sector, and then also specifically to health services, of which patient opinion was the leading and early example, and then later others followed suit in NHS Choices, I Want Great Care, Rate MDs, and so on. In very different ways, by the way. So I'm not going to talk about this microecology within the bigger ecology today, which would be another very interesting topic, but that's something for a different topic. Now, what's interesting about this is that in this quote here, I found there's a very much three stories told about how these schemes work, about how web-based feedback or then web-based patient feedback is supposed to work. And what's striking about this is that these three stories are very, very similar across all these other schemes that I've shown before. So the first story is one of transparency. So there's the claim that comes with these schemes that they will make hidden qualities transparent. If we only get the evaluations of many people together, we will find out something that we haven't known before. That's one very strong claim about transparency. The second strong claim is about accountability, right? It is about, so if we make this public, then people will keep this in mind, whatever they do, and maybe in the future they consider what they do before someone writes a review about it. So this is the idea of accountability in there. And then the third narrative here is about the voice of the local people and about participation. So this is basically a good thing because a lot of people can participate and can join in. This has to do with democracy and engagement. That's a third area which is involved. And as you can see, what we have here is the nice and holy trinity of governance, so transparency, accountability, and participation. And that, of course, has a huge appeal to a lot of people, which may be one of the reasons why this general idea of web-based feedback has been so popular. Now, what I found interesting then, and that was the next step then towards the research project, is to think about, actually, when you read the newspaper and when you read media reports about these themes, actually, it's not as clear-cut a story as this a quote would illustrate, right? So there's been struggles between people who've been, especially doctors, who've been evaluated or assessed publicly and received feedback and who didn't like it, people that complain about exposure, forced exposure, about privacy, people complain about accuracy of feedback, and so on and so on and so on. So an interesting thing is to then take this apart a bit and think about, well, on what kind of assumptions, or as John Law, a social researcher, would say, what hinterland do these claims depend? And then the first one is here that usually these claims come in the form of a very fixed set of actors and entities. So this is clear. This basically, this quote, this report takes for granted that there's something like parents, something like patients, something like local communities, and like public services. So the status of these actors is just taken for granted and not further questioned. Right. Then the second move is usually then, but once you have these two actors, you have the patients and service users on the one hand and the providers on the other hand, then care receives as a human comes about as a very special good, right? It comes about as a service, as something that's provided by one group and received by another group. Then there's usually one more ingredient, which then says it has to do with choice. So there's the belief that choice is something really good and something really desirable for these groups down here. And the basis of choice then goes to the model further is information. And then finally, in this specific case of web-based patient feedback, this choice is mainly then enabled by experience. And experience then is conceived as something that is subjective, which is first of all perceived by the individual, the patient usually, then according to this rule, and is something stable, something that stays constant, and something that's somehow available if we just get the methodology or the technology right as the basis for choice in order to then provide service between the service providers and the service receiver. So I just want to illustrate by taking this apart in this way that these claims and the appeal of these themes very much depends on the rhetoric, which views the world in a very specific way. And so what I try to do in my research is take a different starting point and basically, which is very hard, I have to admit, kind of leave behind many of these ideas and think differently about what's going on. And in this case, I try to understand what I was engaging with, feedback as an in-situated practice. So feedback both as something that's done in a day on the day-to-day basis, and feedback that's done in practice and that you can only engage with when you are in the right situations at the right time. So basically the point then was here, there's little attention to the rather messy, as the many news articles and their concerns indicate, to the very messy and contingent everyday practices and doings that establish, maintain, and disrupt schemes on a day-to-day basis. And here's a quote by Donna Haraway, who's a I don't know what she is. She's a philosopher, a social researcher, who wrote that what counts as experience is never prior to the particular social occasions, the discourses and other practices through which experience becomes articulated in itself and articulable with other accounts and so constructed as collective experience, a potent and often mystified operation. So this is the idea that experience is not something actually that may be readily accessible, that we can just extract from individuals, but something that actually has to be done and maintained on a day-to-day basis, and the stories I'm going to tell you now have exactly to do with that. And then so the research questions very broadly that emerge from that is, well, what does it take to establish, maintain it, and times also disrupt a web-based feedback scheme in practice? And then what kind of moral orders implicated in these activities? And the stories I'm going to tell you now are going to be much more practical. Just to tell you what I actually did, this is me in the upper right corner. This is a snapshot of the patient opinion office, which has changed by now a tiny little bit. This is a colleague of mine on the left-hand side, and this is basically how it looks when you're at patient opinion. So it's not really outrageous or special, right? So it's basically an office environment. It is very special, James, but it is a very, it is just an office environment, right? You have computers, you have keyboards, coffee mugs, and telephones. So what I did is I was lucky enough to be welcomed by James and his team. So I spent a couple of months with them training in the team, mainly as a moderator. That's going to be the first story I'm going to tell you about, my experience of that. That is moderating incoming postings and then participating in all kinds of office activities, which includes Christmas parties, sending out mailings, and doing many of the routine activities that it takes to make a web-based feedback scheme work. So that allowed me to do participant observation and, of course, look a lot at the website and do then documentary analysis with that. Then this put me in a great situation, and this is how the ethnographic strategy unfolded in vivo, so to speak. So this allowed me then to contact authors, because once I was inside the patient opinion team, everyone was really helpful putting me in touch with authors, and I can talk a bit about later on how that exactly worked, because there was a delicate balance exactly because of this kind of challenge between private and public that James talked about earlier and that also Louise, I think, alluded to. So I was able to follow up on specific postings with authors, and then I tried to follow the same postings that I had moderated at Patient Opinion and that I had talked about with the authors then into the hospitals to understand what happened. So the ideal idea was to basically follow postings through the system, which, as you will see very soon, failed in many instances. And first I thought about this as my own failure, but actually this is something that just happens to postings on many occasions. And so this is my research strategy, and this is what happened. And the nice thing, as I said about, is that even a difficulty of accessing a place like this can be indicative of some problem or some interesting question that you can ask yourself. Okay, so that's by way of background, and now I'm going to tell you five stories which, as I said, are not supposed to show you how it really is. And some of these stories are quite exceptional, so they by no means represent the everyday happenings at Patient Opinion. But I chose these stories because I think they are generative, not representative, but generative, and can generate some discussion and help us think about these things. Okay, so the first story takes you into the really difficult, and I have to say with hindsight, very stressful process of moderating postings. So as I think one of the first things that James told me when I asked him what do I need to do in order to understand how patient opinion works, he said, you definitely need to do moderation because in many ways this is at the heart of what we do. And you're going to see in a moment, I think, why that is the case. And what I'm going to do now, I'm going to take you through a posting. From the version, it comes into the computer system. So you sit in front of your screen, there's a new posting coming in, and then it needs to be edited for publication. Now, basically what I'm going to tell you now is the tutorial I got on my third day at Patient Opinion, and which very nicely a colleague of mine at Patient Opinion in the team gave me. So I was the stupid bloody newcomer, and so they had to teach me how it works, which is a great way of learning about an organization. And usually I would need a second screen to have the conversation that was going on the left-hand side here, but I'm going to tell you just what happens. I'm going to paraphrase this. So this was a posting that came in, and let's just have a brief look at it. This posting was about small-town hospital. Of course, it was not small-town hospital. That's my anonymization. And it says, this hospital has been awful for a very long time. My father went into this hospital essentially with a very bad chest. I left him there after he was admitted at around 10 p.m., I went back at 2:30 for visiting the following day to find he had a stroke in the middle of the night. When I arrived, he started crying and hugging me. With one arm, he could still move, relieved that someone was there who could help him. I went to ask the nurses what had happened to him, and they told me he came in like that. A week or so later, after much improvement, able to speak again and walk unaided, he was moved onto the specialist stroke unit. When my brother and I went to visit him after that evening, he had suffered another, this time massive stroke, which again the nurses were unaware of. 24 hours later, we had lost him. Whether they could have prevented his death or not, I don't know, but please don't tell me what he received at their hands was care. So that's a posting that came in. It was one of my first postings. And why I was very moved by the story, because it seemed like a very tough story. I thought there was not much wrong with this posting, because initially my idea was very naive, so I thought moderation would be about cutting out swear words or looking for spam postings and so on. But actually, my colleague, and I call her Helen now, to have a name, basically told me There's a couple of things we need to change about this posting. So the first thing starts right with the first sentence. This hospital has been awful for a very long time. So basically, I first thought it was okay, but then Helen told me, actually, no, this is a problem, because, and she basically deleted the sentence. I kind of simulated this with track changes. This is a problem because that's not his experience, right? This hospital has been awful for a very long time, so this person cannot really know that this person wasn't there. So that's a general claim, so we cut it out. That was the first thing that we did. So then the second thing was, when I arrived, he started crying and hugging me with the one arm he could still move, relieved that someone was here who could help him. That was at least ambiguous, she said, and when she explained it, it then made sense to me, because it's not really clear that the author of the posting was relieved, but actually the author of the posting cannot know, and so we had to add into it, and he told me he was, basically, right, to make clear that this was someone else's idea and not the author's idea. And then I asked her, well, why do we make these edits? So it seems like over the top and very strange. But then she told me, actually, we need to be very careful because of the lawyers, basically. So what's on the line here is the reputation of not just patient opinion, but also of all the people involved. And it's very easy to get into an area which is considered libel. So we basically had to go and tone it down in a way that was safe for these lawyers. So we had an imagined audience of lawyers all of a sudden, which I found very confusing initially, but then it worked out well. So the next thing then we did is we got to this point where he came in like that, which was another challenge, right? Because Helen told me caps, and this is also part of the editorial policy, so it's nothing secret that we did here, really. So she told me, that sounds like screaming, right? Usually when you use big caps, it sounds like screaming. And I actually thought it was okay first, because I thought, okay, maybe this person is screaming, right? But then she said, no, that could be rude and could be perceived like that by some people in the audience, and maybe they would read it differently than I do, which made sense. So what we did then is we took out the caps and basically put it in small caps, that he came in like that, and in order to emphasize the urgency, we added, and I found this alarming. Which you could say is quite different from the original, but it makes a lot of sense, because apparently there's another audience to imagine when you moderate, and to keep in mind, which would have perceived this as rude and kind of offensive, which also makes, of course, a lot of sense. So the next thing we did is we added a paragraph break, which also makes sense. There's a new idea starting here a week or so later, which is for readability, which then is a further audience to keep in mind, and this is an audience of the casual reader who does not want to see a block of text, but basically something that's spaced out a bit and easily readable. What else? We took out the scare quotes from the specialist stroke unit. That's something we argued a lot about, because Helen thought that stare quotes don't make much sense, and I thought they're great, which has to do with my research background, which is where people are very enthusiastic about putting all kinds of words in scare quotes and adding random question marks to sentences and so on. But that's something probably you can do in different ways. That's something we did. What else was here? Then this time, massive stroke, which again, the nurses were unaware of. Again, the problem. The author obviously couldn't know whether the nurses actually were unaware of that, so we added in an I felt like to make it subjective and make it an experience. So then we added another paragraph break, and basically then added also the last sentence, whether they could have prevented his death or not, I don't know, but I do not believe what he received at the hands was care. And of course, all these edits, again, are important from a legal perspective, because it's really important to make it sound really as if the person, or that the person was experiencing it, because if it is an opinion by the person, it's less likely to be libel, right? So that's quite important. And then the last thing we did is, actually we thought about the heading, because this posting was already in a section of this specific hospital, the small town hospital, so we thought that we need a title which is more descriptive. So usually what we did then in moderation is that you take a quote from the posting, if the title is just a generic one, and use this as a title. So in this case, nurses seemed unaware of my father's stroke. So that's the posting, how it eventually turned out. And that's the process of moderation. And I have to say, after my first experience of this, I was quite knackered, really, because it sounds funny, but it is a very stressful and cumbersome experience to have all these different audiences in mind, to juggle them, and then try to configure basically the range of possible readings. So in this case, the lawyers, the casual reader, the people in the hospital, the doctors who read the who might read the posting, the original author, which is very, very difficult to get them all under one umbrella. And actually, in many ways, it may be impossible, but that's the really tough work, which James mentioned earlier. This is the work that basically takes a lot of arguing also within the team, and that's what I at least personally perceived as one of the best things about patient opinion, that these things were not just done, but in all cases in which there was some doubt whether this is okay or not, someone shouted through the office and said, what do you think about this? And then people gathered around a computer and a discussion ensued, and people were shouting so these things. So that's a great thing. Question, of course, then, how scalable is this when there are thousands of postings coming in? But that's a different question. So now this story is not just finished, because what happened next is that basically this story was published on the website, and then 2 or 3 weeks later, actually Dave, the author of the posting, wrote back, and this is on the left-hand side here. So Dave wrote to the info account at Patient Opinion. Everybody can write there. The address is on the website. Hi there. I have some issues about the way my story was edited on Patient Opinion. Whilst I accept that some editing will be necessary for readability, and of course you would need to protect your legal position, however, the certainty with which I worded my story was diluted to produce the ambiguous story you have on your site. If I could remove it, I would. It lacks any impact and tells the story of a son having trouble dealing with the death of a family member. This happened ago. I've dealt with his death and moved on. Hospital have clearly not dealt with the failings which caused so much suffering to a dying man, and that is the story which needs telling. So that was basically what Dave wrote back. Again, this is not representative. It's not that this happens often. Right? It was the only response really of that kind that I saw during my month of work at Patient Opinion. But as I said, I'm telling generative stories, not representative stories. But I think it's interesting because this is a great illustration about what else is at stake in moderating these so-called experiences and postings, right? And what is at stake here is the identity of the people involved. So basically, by rewording slightly and tweaking the posting, what happened is that Dave all of a sudden realized that he is a different Dave. And so what's at stake in editing these things are the identities of all the people involved, and that's another complication in addition to the audience I already mentioned. And then I just put here the response that then my colleague Helen wrote, which is a great response. So she wrote, "Hi, Dave, I'm very sorry to hear that you're unhappy with the way we have edited our story. It was certainly not our intention to dilute your story in any way. As you say, some edits are necessary for legal reasons, and if you wanted to read our editorial policy on the site, you could find it here." It's interesting here that, again, another audience is involved, and this time the audience is not human beings or lawyers, but it is a policy document, right? In this moment, the whole process is held accountable to a policy document which is somewhere on some website indicated by this link. You mentioned you would like to withdraw your posting, you have the right to do this at any time. Would you like me to remove it from the site for you with best wishes, and then Helen? And I think the story ended that he was then fine with having it on the site, and he saw the reasons why it has been edited, and it was okay. But that's something, this process of negotiation is something that happens quite a lot at Patient Opinion, and this, I would say, quite stressful situation of moderating postings with all the audiences, with the risk of reframing the identities of those involved, is quite challenging, and that's something I think that's worth thinking about. It may not be immediately useful for a grand-scale policy discussion, but it's something interesting that that you can keep in mind when thinking about these things. So that was by far the longest story, and the other ones will be much shorter. As I said, I then was able to follow up some of the postings, and I just wanted to briefly mention this one by, as I called the story, Silent Claire, and Claire is the name I gave the lady who wrote this, about the x-ray department. And she writes, "After 4 months of pain, my GP sent me for an x-ray on my leg. I was told and told that if I can walk, there's nothing wrong with my leg. I thought the x-ray was a waste of time. I was told it probably was muscle damage, which could last a lifetime. I said I would go then. I think the answer is what the GP wants, he gets. After weeks of pain, this is just what I wanted to hear. I will think twice about coming to this hospital in the future. So, I mean, it's not a very eloquent posting as opposed to the previous one or the ones that James showed us, but it's also a certain type of posting which is on the site. And this was one, because I thought it was interesting, I followed up. And then the following happened, because I talked to Claire on the telephone, and this is a transcript from the interview. So I basically asked her, so tell me a bit how you came up with the idea of posting on Patient Opinion. That's how I ask people, right, how do they care about it? So what happened was nothing. It was 7 long seconds, and on the phone, 7 seconds can be very long. And then I asked, Claire, are you still there? And she said, yes, I am. I said, oh, good, I thought there was something wrong with the line, apologies. So how did this all start? And then another silence of 8 seconds, and I can really hear her breathing on the phone, right? And then I said, Claire, you're okay? And she said, yeah, well, I did not actually write it. You did not write it? Yes, Suzanne wrote it. Suzanne? Yes, my daughter, she said, we should really do something about the staff at the hospital. I'm 76, and I'm not much into writing anymore. This was one of the many stories about the stories, behind the stories, and the stories, and so on, as you can see, that I discovered when I talked to many of these people, and many of these stories were quite moving, like this one. And I think this is another generative story, because it makes us think about this idea of experience as something that we access in patients, and something that's in an individual, and that is somehow available. So first, of course, you need to be able to articulate it, to write it down in the specific format of this website, which you could regard as a very specific format or genre of writing. Then, of course, another interesting insight here to think with is that experience is not necessarily something that's individual. So in that case, it was written by Suzanne together with Claire. So it was a collective effort, and I haven't even mentioned the work of moderating, right? So there were many more people involved in generating this experience. So it was nothing that was there, it was nothing that was available, but it took a lot of work and specific work to get there, and as you can see, it can also be a very collective social thing and experience, and not necessarily has to do with an individual patient, or not even a patient, can be a daughter. Okay, that was story two. Story three is another very interesting story to think with, and that was another one I was quite fascinated by. It's titled, Why No Decaf at Shotley Bridge? It's about Shotley Bridge Hospital, and the lady called Cleo writes, I always accompany my husband when he has appointments at hospital, and we usually have a cup of tea or coffee before we leave. Up until recently, I've been able to enjoy a cup of decaf coffee in the restaurant, but on the last two occasions, it has had to be a cup of hot water. Why? Because they have installed a new tea coffee machine, and they're no longer able to supply decaf. I asked on both visits for decaf, but the message does not seem to have got through to the relevant department. This is a hospital. I drink decaf for health reasons. Wherever I go, I can get decaf. Even Lidl and Aldi sell decaf. Nowadays, perhaps someone could pop along and buy some. Not good enough, Shotley Bridge. So that's another posting. And again, you could say this is not really a regular posting, because most of the postings are more specifically about some medical treatment. But that's another important posting. So, why did I think this was interesting? I thought it was interesting because it brings up a question that I think is at the heart of many of these themes, and that is, who actually comes to define what counts as care in these situations, right? So for this lady, care is the provision of decaf coffee in the hospital cafeteria. This is very important for her. She accompanies her husband, and for her that's part of the process of supporting her husband, and so on and so on. Now, other people would think differently, and so I had the opportunity in this instance to talk to a chief nurse in this in a hospital next door, so not the same hospital, but one next door, and basically she said, this is a nice one, after I showed her the posting, and she laughed, and I asked her, what do you think? And she said, well, I think it's very interesting. I assume you get a lot of these on an open site, don't you? I think there's no way really to avoid stuff like this. And I asked her, well, what do you mean by it? Avoid. And she says, I mean, you cannot avoid having people write all kinds of stuff on a public website. I mean, this one here, and she points to the printout, this one is not really about care, isn't it? I mean, the lady here is not complaining about treatment or anything. It doesn't seem like she has a serious health problem, you know. She's not, let me see, and she scans the posting. No, she's not even a patient, but she's a carer. Here, and she points to the word carer. So I'd say that's not really our job. God, if she knew what cases I get every day, she would definitely not complain about coffee. After all, we're not a McDonald's, you know. So that's basically what the nurse said, and it's, of course, from her perspective, completely understandable, but it shows you that what's at stake here, this, these different and sometimes clashing ideas of what counts as care and what does not count as care are quite powerful, and they come to the fore in these very specific situations. So in the first case, in my reading of the posting on the website, and in the second case, in this interview situation. And of course, we could now have a discussion about whether this is care or whether this is not care. But I think what's interesting here is that this question comes up in the first place. So the fourth one I can do very quickly. This is about mundane microfiber. And this is basically about a posting, I'm not going to read this out, where Shamu, that's the nickname the person chose, talks about her experience of antenatal care at Tameside General. And basically she tells why she was there. She experienced slight bleeding, she was pregnant, and she says that her overall experience was good and so on. And she further writes, my reason for writing this is that I was concerned by something I witnessed firsthand. I was sat on my bed on the ward when the cleaner came around. I watched as she wiped the window ledges, the retractable tables over the beds, and then, to my horror, she began wiping down the plastic incubators at the side of the beds, all with the same cloth, without rinsing or using any type of cleaning fluid. And then she goes on, I'm not an expert in MRSA, and so on. So that was her concern. So there was this cleaner coming and using the same cloth for all these different things, basically wiping everything at the same time. And this, when I first read it, I thought, it is a valid concern, that's really bad, and I can't imagine that this is hygienic in any way. Now, what's interesting is, now we get into, before the fifth and last story, we get into the area of responses. Now, it's interesting then what I read a couple of days later, what came in as a response, and in this case, Philip Dilek from Tameside Hospital Foundation Trust responded, and he wrote a very kind of unemotional message. He said, the hospital cleaners operate a microfiber cleaning system, which is nationally recognized as providing the best standards of infection control. A clean, damp microfiber cloth is used in each room or area until all eight folded surfaces of the cloth have been used or the area is completed. So basically what this lady first had experienced as bad care, essentially, that's using the same cloth to wipe all kinds of things in the hospital room, turned out to be best practice and the super duper whatever national standard. Now, again, you can say, this is very boring, this posting, right? You can say, there's a posting and this lady just didn't get it, so she's not an expert, and then we know now how it really works. But what I personally find more interesting about this is that when I first read only the posting, I was really convinced that this was bad care. But when I read the response, I thought, this is actually pretty good care. Which then brings up questions about what do we recognize as bad or good care? So if it depends on reading one additional piece of information, that's actually quite quite interesting. And so what power does this have in judging things and evaluating and assessing things? I thought that was quite interesting. So then the last story is that there's more materials on that, but I just focused on this one, is that I managed to follow some postings, I have to say, into the hospitals, which was quite difficult, and it was the same problem that actually the postings have, right, to get into the hospitals and into the right places, as James can tell us more about. So this is a photo I took in the hospital, the first one I went to, and there's a lot to say about this, but let me just briefly say that I was quite impressed, so it was a time till I had been in a hospital, about how regulated and close this hospital environment seemed to me, and how much of a town in its own right a hospital is. So there are these markings on the floor, there's traffic rules, there's people in different uniforms, there's a chapel, there's a supermarket down there. So it's like a little town, basically, a world of its own, which can tell you a lot about the difficulties of getting something in there, which maybe propose a different version of care if all this is geared towards a very specific understanding of provision of care. So then, basically, when I asked the director, so what do you think about patient experience? What do? He basically said, no problem, we take patient experience extremely seriously, and I can show you, and then he took out a folder, and on page whatever, 100 and so-and-so, he showed me this diagram and said, this is patient experience. This is what we do. And so this looks quite different, right, from the stories of Cleo, of Shamu, of John, and all the other people that we've known. He said, yes, this is right here, this is what we do, and this is somewhere where patient opinion fits in. So then he told me, and it's also not that we don't use patient opinion, actually we use it very seriously. He said, we even have a person who takes care of the patient opinion postings about us and monitors it. And so this is an Excel sheet they have in this specific hospital. And it also happened at some others I visited. Basically, what these people then did is they summarized the posting, which already is a summary of a story, in another story, and then put it into a table of contributor, provider, service, positive, negative. That's something they decide themselves and when they read it, and then where it goes, basically. And so I found it quite fascinating that all these little stories, which are so full of, according to my moderation experience, full of emotions and drama and also humor oftentimes, then get put into this different format, which then makes them manageable for a hospital experience. So this is where some of these stories could end up. And then even further, this Excel sheet then was the basis for an internal league table that the director was very proud to show me, where he could basically tell with the positive postings in green, the negatives in red, and the neutral in yellow, he could basically tell which department did how well according to patient opinions. So he basically transformed the idea of stories into more of a performance culture, which is a great feat internally, but it's quite interesting what happens to experience and how experience, and he would still say it's experience and there's no reason to doubt it, how experience is done differently at the hospital. And that's probably 5 or 7 minutes too long. That's what I... that's how I would like to end the fifth story. So to sum up, maybe it would be possible to think about web-based feedback, and especially web-based patient feedback, not so much as the collection of information and the generation of evidence, but about this whole process, actually, from the moderation initially I showed you to all these postings, the responses into the hospitals as part of what is provided as care. So I've tried to show that experience is, in this case, in my experience, actually not straightforwardly available, but needs to be enacted as such in very specific situations again and again and again. A major part of this was to configure the range of possible reading of the readings of the different postings, which involved a lot of negotiations and trouble, as you have seen, of different audiences and identities. Implicated in this process is a very temporary, actually, moral order. So it's not really possible generally to say whether something that counted as care was good or bad, but it depended on very specific situations, on framings, on another word, a sentence someone said. And finally, the stories, of course, are mobilized, which is no surprise, differently in different situations, held together by sometimes stubborn, just remember the hospital and routinized ontologies about what counts as a patient and a care. So it might be worth thinking about this whole process as care in itself, this ongoing tinkering of getting the posting right, of forwarding it, of negotiating, being frustrated, trying to come up with a different remedy, trying to do a slightly different thing, which is very much my experience of the wonderful patient opinion team. And I'm not just saying this because I work with them and James is sitting here. I generally enjoyed it and was a great experience. And this is very much the agonizing, and which I think is kind of typical for my experience of care. So it might be worth thinking about web-based patient feedback through this metaphor. Sorry for running 5 or 7 minutes.
So, thank you, Martin. That was brilliant, rich stuff. James, is there anything you want to say from the kind of the surveillance point of view, having been surveyed?
Right. I'm struggling not to project a sort of moral authority onto you to sort of tell us the truth about things, but I'm going to give up actually and project it anyway. And I'm going to ask you a sort of, you know, should question, which is given all of the issues that you've raised, all the difficulties, the amount of work that goes in, the fact that stories may or may not arrive where they're expected and may be transformed into other things when they get there, is it all worth it? What's your sort of sense? I mean, you've probably looked at this more than anybody else. Do you think it's all worth it? I know it's an impossible question.
Yeah, no, I probably can't say this in general. I can only say for me personally, it's definitely worth it because it tries to get at something as opposed to many other evaluation schemes or performance measures that are out there, actually, which is quite rare. And this is to get to this moment, but this is just a personal thing, really, to get to this moment where you realize in what you're doing that it could be otherwise. So you realize in this moment that actually maybe care is something different than what I thought in my day-to-day work, or maybe there's something else to it. And what I find fascinating is to realize that there is this moment, as people have called this a moment of wonder, for instance, or disconcertment, there's different words for this. But what then happens when you realize this? Because one natural reaction is to go to a defense mode and say, no, it's something else, it's different, and then to fall back onto your routinized and common way of things. And for me, the big riddle is to actually try to provoke and disturb and disconcert people to realize it could be otherwise, and maybe changing their way of thinking about things. But this is probably a hopelessly naive or so a dream or idea. But I think these moments, which in this case, in my experience of doing this ethnography, were very real, are quite fascinating. So that's something I really very much appreciate. And for that reason, I would say yes, definitely, yeah. Which is different from many of the other web-based themes that are out there, actually.
In the meantime, can I say thank you to James and Martin for a fantastic evening.